My guest for the Conversations with the Remarkable Minds segment of our program is Professor James Gustav Speth. Professor Speth is one of America's true progressive leaders in the environmental movement. He was a co-founder of the National Resources Defense Council and served as CEO of the United Nations Development Program. He is currently a professor of law at the University of Vermont, but he was the former dean of Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Sciences for decades, I believe almost 40 years. In the past, Professor Speth served as the chairman for President Jimmy Carter's Council on Environmental Quality, and under President Carter, he was a senior advisor on these issues. Then he moved over to President Clinton's transition team, and he is an author. He is respected because he looks at something with a different perspective. He is the author of several books. His latest, America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. Nice to have you with us again.
Hi, Gary. It's good to be back with you. I enjoyed the show last time.
Thank you. I would like to go into depth on a few issues here and then turn it over to you.
Sure.
I'd like to begin with a short quote from you. We tend to see growth as an unalloyed good, but an expanding body of evidence is now telling us to think again. Economic growth may be the world's secular religion, but for most, it is a God that is failing, underperforming for most of the world's people and creating more problems than it solves for those in an affluent society, end quote. So my question is this. When we look at what the growth-only ideology has brought us, particularly in the U.S. where it is most dominant, and compared to other developed nations, the U.S. ranks near the bottom of the heap across the board, the highest poverty rate for developed nation, the greatest inequality and lowest maternal well-being of children, the highest infant mortality rate ranked second to last, the highest in homicides and suicides, the worst gender inequality for developed nations, the highest health care expenditures and poorest medical practice outtake to boot, and the lowest environmental performance, and on and on. So begin by identifying the relationship between this growth imperative that infuses the American politic and economy, and then the nation's dismal performance in the issues I just listed, and one final overview. When I look at China, that is slowing down and hiding its problems by having astronomical inventories of cars and building materials. But mind you, other countries can't do this. They can because they're co-partners in many of their ventures. They're just not showing us that a lot of people are not buying, and hence their economy is kept artificially high. Then you look at other countries that are slowing down. Brazil slowing down, India slowing down, and South Korea slowing down, and Russia slowing down. And yet we're told everyone has to go forward. There was a point for 10 years where we were going forward at about 7 to 10% growth domestic product rate a year. Everything was expanding. Now you look at the largest economy in the world, the European Union. It's larger than the United States. It's larger than China. It's going off a cliff. Spain, Italy, Greece, Ireland, England, Portugal, they're dead economically unless someone wipes out all their debts and encourages them to reinvest in their own local economies. And otherwise, this austerity program is killing them. And yet we in the United States are saying, aren't they doing a good job over there? See how they're tightening the belts? Yeah, you just took away 40% of a person's pension. What are they supposed to live on? They're dumpster diving. And we don't care. Romney wants to increase the military spending. What kind of insanity? So I'm saying, why can't we take a policy and stop growth domestic product and start reducing our growth with the intent of having not a growth, but rather a sustainable future where we don't overexhaust our natural resources and the people in the process? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, that was a good summation, Gary. I go through that data that you went in, about where the U.S. is now. I looked at 20 different, the most developed countries, and 30 indicators of national well-being and international citizenship. And the U.S. is right at, or almost at, the very bottom of all of those indicators. It's a great tragedy. And it's happened, as you point out, in the teeth of a tremendous economic expansion. I mean, since 1980, the size of the U.S. economy has more than doubled. It's grown by 125% since 1980. And during that time, the first problem with growth is that it's not delivering. It's just simply not delivering. During that time since 1980, you know, we lost 42,000 manufacturing plants. Jobs fled our borders. Life satisfaction flatlined. Environment declined sharply. Levels of trust went down. Depression went up. Toxification continued. Inequality and poverty mounted sharply. I mean, that's what we did when we were growing. So the first problem with growth is that it really isn't delivering. And you can look again at the very current situation that we are in. The economy now is back higher than, you know, there's more GDP. And by growth, I mean GDP growth. The GDP is now higher than it was before the 2008 recession. And yet we still have this, unemployment problems, so many people in part-time jobs, so many people dropped out of the labor force, you know, plus close to 8% measured unemployment. So that, you know, the economy's back, the market is back, profits are back, people aren't back. So the growth really doesn't deliver. The second thing about growth is that it when you prioritize growth as a national objective, you in effect empower those who we look to deliver the growth. And in this case, it's the corporations, the private sector. And our government is hooked on growth, and it doesn't own much of the economy, so it's got to also give the corporations what they need to keep growing in an economy that where growth is the overarching priority. And the third thing growth does is it deflects our attention to this prioritization, this growth fetish does, is that it deflects our attention from trying to grow the things that really do need to be grown. We do need good jobs to grow. We need infrastructure to grow. We need a renewable, green energy to grow. We need health care to grow. And we have a lot of things that do need to improve and grow. And by simply, invoking aggregate economic expansion as measured by GDP as the be-all and end-all of national policy, we end up not trying to grow the things that we really do need to grow. But the moment you say we need to focus on the things that are important to grow and be sure that we are growing those things, basically you're saying we need a responsible government. We need a capable, democratically controlled government, because government policy is what is going to channel investment and growth in the right directions. So I think that these issues are linked up. We need to think not in terms of we hear so much in this campaign about reviving the economy, getting the economy growing again, over and over again, both parties. The fact is, the real choice facing us is not how to get the economy moving again. The real choice that we ought to be facing up to is how do we transform the economy, not simply revive it. And, you know, the old economy was a pretty sad place, still is a pretty sad place. Cranking it up isn't going to solve our problems. We need to transform the economy, and that's why a lot of us are coming together now in what we're calling the New Economy Movement, with the objective of really deep changes in our society and in our economy that would lead, that would put really at the core of economic life the objective of sustaining people and place and planet, rather than promoting profit and power and production. And once we have that, that fundamental shift, I think we'll have an economy that is routinely delivering good results for people and place and planet. And that's what my book, America the Possible, is really all about. How do we get off the track we're on, get on a different track of building this new economy, of putting this new economic paradigm at the very center of economic life? And the book goes through the ways that I think we need to go in order to get to that result. It talks about a series of a dozen transformations in our economic life and in our politics.
I'm going to ask you then to be a little more detailed and go through each of those 12. And I want to go back to something you said earlier. Our gross domestic product is not accurate, just like our unemployment figure. Just mysteriously and miraculously, they gave us an unemployment figure that dropped from 8.1 down to 7.8% as 114,000 new jobs. That's not even sufficient to stay even with population growth. And what we see then is that there were over 600,000 people who simply stopped looking for work.
Yes.
They had given up. And there are up to now 5.5 million Americans who've stopped, meaning you don't see them on any official government roll, and hence they're no longer considered unemployed. Now, the media have to know that. The economists working for Fox and CNBC and the others have to know that. So why wouldn't anyone call out the president or anyone else who says, oh, look, we only have an 8.1% unemployment rate, and we have at least a 19 to 20% unemployment rate in the actual world. But if you say that you've tried your hardest, I know people, by the way, who've sent out 5,000 resumes, have master's degrees, can't get work, and are living at home and no longer go out. They're too depressed. They stay at home. Well, there are 5 million of them now. So we take 5 million people who should make the unemployment rate go up to at least 17.2%, and we just simply take them off because the media is allowing the government and the administration to play a game, at least in Spain, when they say there's a 51% unemployment rate for 25-year and under, and there's an official 19% unemployment rate for the country. They're being honest. Other countries are at least honest. We're not. And also, why doesn't anyone tell us that between 12 and 17% of the gross domestic product is from the financial industry, and that means they made money off money? They didn't invest a nickel in new businesses or ways that actually cause growth across the multiple economies and classes of people. They made it off all forms of exotic derivatives. Well, if you take as much as 17% of your entire gross domestic product, it does not benefit anyone except a small group of banks, investment houses, hedge funds, and equity partners, then that doesn't represent a legitimate gross domestic product. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think you've got it absolutely right. The great tragedy is that we have huge unmet national needs. We have vast armies of unemployed, underemployed, formerly employed people eager to work and help meet those needs. And we have trillions, literally, of dollars sitting around with corporations not spending them. And if we really want to put America back to work, we're going to have programs led by governments at all levels to stimulate growth in particular sectors of high social and environmental importance, particular sectors of where there's a democratic priority, a democratic judgment that this is something we ought to be growing. And so we're very far from that now, because all our political dialogue wants to talk about is stimulating this aggregate GDP to expand. And I think you're absolutely right that at any plausible rate of GDP growth, we're not going to put America back to work again. You asked me a moment ago about some specifics and different areas. Well, what are some of these areas where the book discusses the need for transformative change, the need for system change? And I think I'm going to list a few for you and your listeners. But as I do, remember that in each of these areas, we know a lot about how to make the transformation. Can't go into too much detail, but we know a lot about how to make the transformation in each of these areas, and that's what, you know, my book, America the Possible, goes into. One obvious area is the transformation of the corporation. We need to move from shareholder primacy to stakeholder primacy, from one ownership model, shareholders and owners, to a lot of different business models and a lot of different types of ownership, where there's a real democratization of ownership. There's a lot more worker ownership, as in co-ops, and consumer ownership, as in co-ops, and there, and you know, different types of ownership of capital. The democratization of capital. In money and finance, we ought to be trying to really rein in Wall Street and shift our emphasis back to Main Street banking and finance, like we had after World War II. And I think we this is difficult, I think, for to convey, but we need to. Most money is created through bank debt. When people take out loans from banks, in effect, the bank's lending money they don't have, and for the most part, and that creates money in the economy. Well, I think the creation of money, as Lincoln did before and others have advocated, needs to shift back to something that is a governmental function, not a bank function.
If you did that, you realize what would happen. You would immediately be able to have zero interest. Think of what that would mean to just servicing the national debt. You go to a zero interest on service rather than what it is now, $585 billion this year.
Well, you wouldn't really have to borrow
the Treasury would print money.
And I think, you know, the pitfall that you have to avoid is pumping too much money out there and creating inflation. But, that's just one thing you have to manage in your monetary policy. We talked about the need to transform from this growth fetish that we have to what I call the post-growth society, and growth in democratically determined priorities. A fundamental shift is needed is in social conditions, from this vast economic insecurity that we have to real fairness, and from joblessness to real jobs. And we know a lot about how to create jobs if we really, you know, could get the politics straightened out.
What would you do about breaking the trust and the monopolies that now, through the leveraging of debt, are able to buy up all their competition? And keep in mind, when the TARP program was offered, and we were told with such vigor by those in both parties, this is the only thing that will save the economy. The first thing we saw them spending money on was buying up their competition that had nothing to do with helping them. They just simply took out all the weaker players in the field that they then absorbed in. Then they strengthened their own asset base. Then they got rid of the toxic debt. They upped the price of the value of their own stock to support their own stockholders. What in the world did that have to do with helping the average American?
Darn little, and it's good to see at least some lawsuits being brought to reclaim some of that on behalf of those who took big losses, and perhaps to bring some criminal prosecutions finally as well. I think, you asked me what I would do. A friend of mine, Gar Alperovitz, a great thinker in our country, had an article in the New York Times where he pointed out that, when you get too big to fail, as these banks now have, due to the even more so now than before 2008, is going to be very important to step in and to have government, regulate these entities like it regulates public utilities now, or to take a big ownership share in these companies. As we have done on a temporary basis in with AIG and General Motors, because basically they are public functions at that point, and they ought to be a major hand of the democratic hand in their operation. Now, again, that underscores the fact that we're going to have to change our politics, because right now the government isn't that competent, and right now it isn't under firm democratic control. We have this creeping corporatocracy and plutocracy that we see unfold every day. I think another area of change is really a new system of national indicators beyond GDP. We've talked about GDP and its limitations. Bobby Kennedy, in his last speech in 1968, made probably the most profound attack on GDP as a measure of well-being. It just aggregates everything, good, bad, and indifferent. You have a big spill in the Gulf, and GDP goes up. You clear-cut all your forest, and GDP goes up. I think we need new indicators, and there's a movement underway to do new indicators, at least at the state level. Maryland and Vermont and other states are experimenting with a new measure of overall well-being. The consumerism is something that, our extraordinary affluenza was something that was created intentionally with policy that favored mass consumption and stimulated people to think all the time about getting and spending. That was something that was an artifact of public policy after World War II. And there's a lot that we can do to shift emphasis away from consumerism to from more to enough, from owning to sharing. A lot of interest in the sharing economy now in our country. I think obviously another area for deep changes in foreign policy and in our military. We're neglecting so many of the big global problems. And I put climate right there at the top of that list. At the same time, we're spending 2/3 of the discretionary budget of the federal government on security. And we're spending almost half the world's military expenditure every year, 70% of the arms sales. It's estimated we have about 1,000 military bases around the world. We may have covert or clandestine operations on the ground in as many as the third or more of the world's countries now. This militarization and the power of the arms industry and I think it was Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times who said, when you have an armful of hammers, everything looks like a nail, and we have an armful of weapons, and our first kind of response that
everyone looks like a terrorist.
Everyone looks like a terrorist or a threat of some type. Mm-hmm. And so we have these areas where there are, other things in communities, in our core values. Patrick Daniel Moynihan made a great statement one time, among others, which was that the central conservative truth is that culture really matters and values really matter and determine the fate of societies. But the central liberal truth, he said, is that a society and a politics can change the culture intentionally and save it from itself. And so cultural change, value change is something that that we can promote in our society, and we've changed values on a lot of things through that in the past, and we need to address this. What values do we really need for the future? I got into this America the Possible book and wrote it thinking about my grandchildren, and I have 5 now and 6 on the way. You think about what is the world that we're headed towards for them. What's the world of 2050 that we seem to, that the trends we're trending towards? It's a world and a country of widespread poverty and inequality and insecurity and a huge sort of underclass of people and the rich living in gated communities, in effect, in lots of different ways. It's a world of, extensive deprivation of privacy and human rights. It's a world of climate disruption and tremendous environmental losses and biodiversity, toxification of our lives. It's a world of militarization and endless warring. And it's a world of this creeping plutocracy and corporatocracy. Got to remember, the corporations, you know, the rich are spending a lot on these elections, and corporations are spending a lot, but corporations spend a lot more on lobbying than they do on election finance. And you know, our society is losing its core democracy as a result of this these processes that we're seeing right now in this election season. So my hope is that at the, you know, when this election's over and people sit back and take stock at what they've just seen, that there will be the birth of a movement in our country to straighten out our politics, to reclaim our democracy, to identify an agenda of pro-democracy political reform and pursue it. And all the progressives and others are going to have to come together and do that, or we don't have much of a chance with anything.
Professor Speth, we're out of time for this segment. I could not agree with you more. I have said that all along. I said that we've got to forget about the Green Party and the independent parties. We've got to come together as a people's party, surrender the ego at the door, work together after this election cycle for new common good. There are millions, tens of millions of those out there who face socially, politically, economically, environmentally, and ethically and spiritually challenged issues. And they want to hear a message that is rational behind what they can do. What can I do as an individual? What can I do with you? How can we work together? And that's why independent progressive media, and that's what this is, has struggled with a large media conglomerate challenging it, because the average American public doesn't turn to us. They turn to that media to be entertained and misinformed. So you have suggested in your book, America the Possible, how progressive media can better undermine corporate media and pull people away from the circus of corporate bot talking heads and their so-called experts. So you've opened a door, and there are a lot of people walking through it now. I would be very optimistic about what our possibilities are for not reforming anything, but transforming it. I want to thank you for all of your decades of outstanding work on behalf of all of us.
Well, thank you, Gary.
Professor James Gustav Speth, my guest. I'm Gary Nall.